Terrific. Thank you, Peter, for that. And welcome everyone on this live lecture. It is a great pity that Guy can't be here in person in Perth to deliver the lecture, but very understandable in light of what is happening in Sydney at the moment with COVID. As Peter mentioned, I have the great privilege of serving on the board of the RBA, which means I work alongside Guy, and really Guy hardly needs an introduction. He obviously serves as the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. He took that role and was appointed to it in September of 2016. He is also Deputy Chair of the RBA Board and is Chair of the Reserve Bank's Risk Management Committee. Prior to that, Guy was the Assistant Governor for Financial Markets. Guy has also been appointed as Chair of the Global Foreign Exchange Committee. Prior to that, he was Chair of the Bank of International Settlements Foreign Exchange Working Group, responsible for the development of the Global Code of Conduct for the foreign exchange market, as well as the Chair of the Australian FX Committee. Previous to the RBA, Guy has worked at the IMF, the Bank for International Settlements, Australian Treasury, and has been a visiting professor in economics at MIT. He graduated from the University of Adelaide with an honours degree in economics and also has a PhD in economics from MIT. Guy is married, as I said, lives in Sydney, has three daughters, born and raised in Adelaide, as I said, living in Sydney, but is a very strong Carlton Football Club supporter, so go figure. It's with great pleasure that I introduce Guy. Thank you very much, Guy.
Thanks very much, Mark. And as Mark said, I'm very sorry that I'm able to be there in person tonight. I was looking good up until yesterday with some COVID cases in the eastern suburbs, which happens to be where I live, as you may have read in today's press. I was very much looking forward to come over because I was looking for the opportunity to draw a bigger crowd than the Derby did last weekend, because I was looking forward to playing to a crowd, whereas the Dockers and the Eagles had to play to no crowd. But I'll have to save that opportunity up for another time. But I'm very much looking forward to the opportunity to speak to you all tonight, and particularly honoured to be giving the Shan lecture. So let me just briefly talk a little bit about Edward Shan, which I assume most of you know, that his work had a lasting impact on Australian economic thought. As an economic historian, Shan looked to the past to inform solutions to the most important problems of his time, including for him, how to lift Australia out of the Great Depression. And many of Shan's key contributions seem orthodox today, but were well ahead of his time back in the 30s. He advocated for the removal of tariffs, a shift away from centralized wage fixing, and a move to a more flexible exchange rate. Shan also saw an important role for an independent central bank to prevent and respond to crises. He was widely regarded as an excellent teacher who left a significant impact on his students. And one particular student, which was particularly important to me, was Nugget Coombs, the Reserve Bank's first governor. Coombs described Shan as supremely capable of communicating the excitement of intellectual exploration and establishing the sense of social responsibility which should guide those who work in academic fields, something that Coombs very much emulated in his own career. So, taking inspiration from Shan tonight, I will talk to you about the role the Reserve Bank has played in responding to the current crisis, one of the largest contractions in economic output we've seen in Australia, about the largest since the Great Depression. So, first of all, what I'm going to do is describe and spend most of the time describing what the Reserve Bank has done over the past year to support the economy through the COVID pandemic. I'll talk about why we have taken these actions and give you some of the thinking behind the policy decisions. Then I'll look at the outcomes of these policy actions to date. And then finally, I'll highlight some of the issues the bank will be thinking about in the period ahead. Where are we going to go from here? So the Reserve Bank has taken a number of complementary policy actions to support the Australian economy since the onset of COVID. And this slide here summarizes the four main types of actions that we've taken. We lowered the policy interest rate, the cash rate, to near zero. set a target for the three-year government bond yield. We've enhanced the forward guidance that the board provides about future movements in the cash rate. We've commenced a program of purchasing government bonds and provided long-term low-cost funding to the banking system through the term funding facility. So what I'm going to do for the next while is explain each of these actions in more detail. The overall aim of all these monetary policy actions has been to support economic activity in Australia through a number of channels. The policy actions have underpinned record low funding costs across the financial system and for governments. The lower borrowing costs free up cash flow for both households and businesses, some of which is then spent. The lower interest rates and the funding for the banking system support the flow of credit to households and businesses. And lower interest rates also support asset prices, which boost balance sheets and thereby consumption and investment. And finally, a lower structure of interest rates leads to a lower value of the Australian dollar than would otherwise be the case. The end result of all of that is a stronger Australian economy. So the policy response over the past year has evolved as information about the extent of the pandemic and its economic impact have unfolded. So the initial policy decisions were taken in March 2020, including at an unscheduled policy meeting on the 18th of March. Further measures were announced in September and November 2020, and then in February 2021. If we take you back to March 2020, as the impact of the virus and the health policy actions on the Australian economy became evident, the Reserve Bank Board put in place a comprehensive package at that unscheduled meeting to support jobs, incomes, and businesses in Australia so that when the health crisis receded, the country was well placed to recover strongly. And that package comprised a number of elements, which I've got here on the slide. A reduction in the cash rate target, the policy rate, the 25 basis points, and we just reduced it at the earlier meeting, in the regular meeting in March, to 50 basis points. The board provided forward guidance that we would not be increasing the cash rate until progress is being made towards full employment, and that we were confident that inflation would be sustainably within the 2 to 3% target band. We reduced the interest rate paid on exchange settlement or ES balances. That's the balances that the banking system holds with us here at the Reserve Bank, the 10 basis points. So the one thing you've got to keep in your mind over the next chunk of the speech is this ES balancing, because I'm going to come back to it a few times, and it's a bit more important today than it has been for quite some time. So you can keep that concept floating around somewhere in your head over the next while. We also introduced a target on the three-year Australian government bond yield of 25 basis points. And we undertook bond purchases in the market to address the dysfunction in the bond market, which was occurring at that time. That was occurring both here and all around the world. And we introduced a term funding facility, or TFF, for the banking system, where we were banks basically were able to borrow funds equivalent to 3% of their lending from the Reserve Bank for 3 years at a very low rate of 25 basis points. And that they could do that up until at that stage, the end of September 2020. And the TFF provided additional incentives to support lending to businesses, particularly small and medium-sized businesses. So that was what we undertook in March 2020. If we move forward to September 2020, so as I mentioned, the initial deadline for the TFF funding was the end of September. As that deadline approached, the board decided to expand the TFF to provide an additional amount of low-cost funding to the banking system equivalent to 2% of lending in the banking system. So the initial three plus another two. And we also decided to allow that banks to borrow funding under the TFF up until June 2021. In October then, we changed our forward guidance to focus on actual outcomes for inflation rather than expected outcomes, which is what we'd said in March. And I'm going to go a bit later on in the talk into more detail about what that actually means and the consequence of that. Then at the November meeting last year, the board decided on a further package of measures to support the economy. We reduced the cash rate target, the three-year yield target, and the interest rate on the TFF to 10 basis points. At the same time, we reduced the interest rate on ES balances from 10 basis points to zero. And we introduced a program of government bond purchases of $100 billion focused on the 5 to 10 year segment of the government bond market. We said that we would buy $100 billion of government bonds over the following 6 months in the secondary market, purchasing government bonds issued both by the Australian government as well as by the states. So why did we take that decision in November? It was because we made the assessment that Australia was facing a prolonged period of high unemployment and we also assessed that inflation was unlikely to return sustainably to the target range of 2 to 3% for at least 3 years. Then in February 2021, to provide further support for the Australian economy as it recovered, so we've moved through the period now where the peak impact of the health of COVID had hit the economy to when the Australian economy is beginning to open up. So as the economy is recovering, the board announced it would purchase an additional $100 billion of government bonds after that first $100 billion was completed. And that's where we are now. Those purchases are currently underway today, including buying $2 billion worth more today. So the policy actions were taken again to deliver to low funding costs have had a number of complementary elements. So many of these elements are mutually reinforcing in underpinning the low interest rates across the economy. So let me now go through each of these actions in detail, but bearing in mind, that, as I said, that all of these actions are working in concert rather than independently of each other. So the first policy action I want to talk about is the reduction in the cash rate target. So that's the red line on this graph. You can see it coming down to 50 basis points at our early March meeting, another 25 basis points at the unscheduled March meeting, and then the target reduced to 10 at the November meeting. So reductions in the cash rate, sorry, it's the blue line in this graph. The reductions in the cash rates have been the primary lever of monetary policy for more than three decades now. The effect of this reduction in the cash rate on financial markets and the economy has been very similar to the experience over those past three decades. So how does a reduction in the cash rate work? So reduction in the cash rate provides stimulus to the economy through a number of channels. When the cash rate is lowered, it reduces funding costs for the banking system, which in turn flows through to lowering borrowing rates for household and businesses. So lower mortgage rates, lower business borrowing rates. Those lower borrowing rates stimulate borrowing and economic activity. The lower cash rate and the borrowing rates also boost the cash flow of existing borrowers, those with loans already. The lower cash rate supports asset prices, including housing prices, which boosts household wealth and hence spending and also activity in the housing market in terms of construction. In addition, it puts downward pressure on the Australian dollar, which is stimulatory for the economy. The board has reduced the cash rate target to what we assess to be the effective lower bound of 10 basis points. And we've stated that we don't see negative rates as being appropriate in Australia in the current circumstances. And I see there are at least two reasons for this. First, there's some uncertainty about the efficacy of negative rates, including because of their negative effect on savers. And second, at least as important to me, there are other actions that the bank could take to provide monetary policy stimulus. And indeed, we have taken those actions. If looking at this graph, there's an additional aspect of the cash rate reduction that I think is important to highlight. So you can see that blue line coming down to 10 basis points, but the red line has come down even further. And then the dotted line, which is the ES rate, has fallen all the way to zero. So as the cash rate target was reduced, that remuneration rate on the deposits the banks have with us was also reduced, and it's down to zero now. So when the cash rate target is reduced, the ES rate is always reduced. And normally that's not important to anyone outside of those who manage the banking system's accounts at the RBA. But this time around, as I said, it's got quite a bit more significance. So before March this year, the cash rate target set by the board was the primary anchor for money markets in the Australian economy and hence the whole structure of interest rates in the Australian financial system. The actual cash rate, that's the rate which banks actually borrow and lend their balances to each other each day, was almost always equal to the cash rate target for the last 20 years. The Reserve Bank conducted its daily market operations to keep the size of that market, the market for ES balances, very small. There was minimal excess liquidity in the market. So the demand and supply pressures in that market generally ensured the cash rate traded at the cash rate target each day. So the cash rate and the cash rate target were one and the same thing, pretty much every day. But because of the actions that the other actions that we have taken, particularly the bond purchases and the term funding facility, exchange settlement balances are now very large. They're not 2 billion, they're now around 200 billion. So put simply, the banking system has a very large amount of deposits at the RBA today. There's now a large amount of liquidity in the system. So some banks, not many, still need to borrow overnight in the market to ensure their balance with us remains positive each day, but these amounts are very small. And at the same time, there are a lot of banks with very large ES balances who are quite happy to lend to them. So given this balance of a lot of not very much demand and a hell of a lot of supply, the actual cash rate, the red line here, is trading just above the ES rate of zero. It's trading at 3 basis points today, as it has done for the last while. So in technical terms, basically what we're doing now, for any of you who remember ever studied monetary policy in any great detail, we're operating a floor system rather than a corridor system for the cash rate. So the actual cash rate, as I said, is around 3 basis points, and it's been there for quite some time. So that actual cash rate is still the anchor for the structure of interest rates in the Australian financial system, but it's anchored to the exchange settlement rate rather than the cash rate target, which has been historically the primary determinant of the cash rate. So it's that ES balance rate which is actually the primary determinant of the cash rate today. Now, when we implemented all these policy changes, we fully expected that this would be the outcome, that we would see this decline in the cash rate towards just above zero, given the large increase in liquidity in the system. And given that exchange settlements balances are going to remain at a high level for quite a number of years until the funds provided to the banking system under the TFF are repaid, and until the government bonds that the RBA has bought mature, then ES balances are going to remain at a very high level for a very long time. And this ES balance rate is going to continue to be the main anchor of the cash rate. So I promise that's about as esoteric as we're going to get for the rest of the speech. But the reduction in the cash rate target, the remuneration on ES balances, and the actual cash rate has seen all short-term interest rates in the Australian financial system decline to historically low levels, including the important bank bill swap rate, or BBSW, which is a primary determinant of particularly of business borrowing rates, but also of other borrowing rates in the economy. So as the graph shows, as you can see, the cash rate has come down towards 3 basis points. BBSW rate has fallen even further than it was because of the availability of low-cost funding to the banking system. So BBSW used to trade quite a bit above the cash rate back at the beginning of March. Now it trades very slightly above the cash rate, including a few times below the cash rate. So that directly translates to lower borrowing costs for both businesses and households. So in turn, these short-term interest rates, along with the low-cost funding available through the term funding facility, have reduced the funding cost of the banking system and delivered these reductions in large declines in household and business borrowing rates, you can see on this graph. So that's the average borrowing rate paid by households in the top half of the graph, and the average borrowing rate paid by businesses from small to large in the bottom part of the graph. So you can see those borrowing rates have declined considerably, particularly over the last 12 months or so as we put these policy rates in place. And they've declined to the lowest levels they've been historically. Let me now turn to talk about forward guidance. So the RBA's policy announcements have provided enhanced forward guidance about the board's expectations for the future path of monetary policy. So the cash rate tells you about the current path of monetary policy. The forward guidance tells you about the board's expectations for the future path of monetary policy. And the guidance takes the form of describing the economic conditions the board would be looking to see before it would consider raising the cash rate. That is, the guidance is based on the state of the economy. The board's guidance, as I mentioned earlier, has evolved over the past year to emphasise outcomes rather than forecasts. That is, the board has stated that it will not increase the cash rate until actual inflation, not forecast inflation, but actual inflation, is sustainably within the target range. In addition, it has stated this will require a lower rate of unemployment and a return to a tight labour market. Now, that sort of guidance based on the state of the economy is meaningful for financial market participants and for economists, but for many people, they're more interested about the bank's views as to about how long it will be before the economy will reach these conditions. They want to know how long it will be before interest rates start to rise. And hence, the bank has provided a possible time frame along its description, alongside its description of the state of the economy required before how long that's going to be before we'd consider a rise in the cash rate. And at the May board meeting earlier this week, the board reiterated that it's in our central scenario, these economic conditions are unlikely to be met until 2024 at the earliest. That is, we don't think it's going to be likely you're going to be raising the cash rate until 2024 or considering raising the cash rate until 2024 at the earliest. And that forward guidance complements the three-year government bond yield target and has helped underpin the low level of interest rates across the economy. But I would highlight that even though we provide that time dimension, it's actually the state of the economy which is ultimately going to be the key determinant of those policy settings. Let me now turn to talk about government bond purchases. And they've been comprised of three elements. Purchases to maintain the three-year yield target, which were introduced back in March. Since November 2020, the government bond purchase program, and then purchases to address market dysfunction, particularly back in March and April last year. So I'll talk through each of these in a bit more detail, starting with the three-year yield target. So it's from March 2020, this graph shows the total amount of purchases we've done to date, both split between Australian government bonds, AGS, and state government bond purchases. So from March 2020, the RBA commenced purchasing government bonds focused on the three-year point of the yield curve. So why do we do that? So that's because in Australia, most borrowing is at variable rates that key off the front part of the yield curve. This is in contrast to other markets around the world, particularly the US, where longer-term yields are more important benchmark for borrowing rates. So this three-year yield target has helped anchor the Australian yield curve and has had significant traction in lowering borrowing rates for households and businesses, together with the other policy measures adopted. It has also helped reinforce the RBA's forward guidance regarding the cash rate. And it's appropriate to characterise this policy as a yield target, not yield curve control. That is, we're targeting only one part of the yield curve, not trying to control the curve as a whole. To maintain this target, the bank has conducted auctions to buy the three-year target bond when the yield has moved above the target in a material and sustained way. And such purchases have been necessary on relatively few occasions. Much of the time, the market has had sufficient confidence in the sustainability of the target that the yield has been anchored close to it, which was 25 basis points from March to November and is now 10 basis points. So initially the target was for the April 2023 bond, because that was 3 years away from March 2020 when we introduced that. Subsequently, the target was changed to the April 2024 bond when it became the closest bond to maturing to the three-year horizon. In March earlier this year, the board agreed that would not consider removing the yield target completely or changing the target yield of 10 basis points when we review the target bond later in the year. What we said was either if the board were to maintain the April 2024 bond as the target bond rather than move to the next bond maturity that becomes closer to the three-year horizon, the maturity of the target would gradually decline until the bond finally matured in April 2024. And we've said just earlier this week, we're going to consider whether to extend the target from the current April 2024 bond to the November 2024 bond at our next meeting in July. Now, what I'd like to talk about in more detail is the bond purchase program itself. So in November 2020, the board announced a quantity-based bond purchase program that is complementary to the three-year yield target. And so what I'm going to do now is talk about how do these bond purchases actually work. And this schematic gives you a bit of an idea, which I'm going to talk you through a bit. The board decided to implement this policy for a number of reasons back in November. So back in November, what we took account of was that longer-term Australian government bond yields were higher than those in other advanced countries. So that while the three-year yield target had provided an effective anchor for the three-year yield, longer-term government bond yields were higher than those elsewhere. We took that as evidence that the size of other central banks' bond purchase programs were affecting longer-term Australian bond yields beyond the anchoring effect of our three-year target. This, in turn, was contributing to a higher exchange rate, which was restraining the recovery in the Australian economy. And so that program that we announced back in November was for the purchase of $100 billion worth of bonds of maturities of around 5 to 10 years over the following 6 months. And that was split between $80 billion for the Australian government and $20 billion for bonds issued by the state governments. And then, as I said, we announced an additional $100 billion with that same composition and rate of purchase back in February. The bonds are purchased in the secondary market through transparent auctions. So we opted not to extend that yield target, which would have been an option, that three-year yield target, to a longer horizon for a number of reasons. First, the yield target reinforces the board's forward guidance on the cash rate. 3 years is a reasonable horizon over which we have some confidence about the economic outlook. Beyond that horizon, the economic outlook is considerably less certain, and with it, confidence about the second settings of monetary policy. Secondly, further out along the yield curve, other factors also start to have a greater influence on yields, particularly global developments. So you might recall, so bond purchases have returned to the central bank toolkit in a number of advanced countries in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. You might recall that economic textbooks used to talk about monetary policy in terms of buying and selling government bonds to control the money supply. But since the late 80s, or thereabouts, short-term policy rates rather than bond purchases have generally been the primary tool of monetary policy. But when interest rates fell to their lower bound after the GFC in some economies, including the US and Europe, central banks in a number of economies turned to bond purchases to provide additional stimulus. So how does that stimulus actually work? So if you look at this diagram, starting from the top, when the central bank buys a bond, so that's the asset purchases, it's putting downward pressure on government bond yields. So you can think of the central bank being an additional buyer of government bonds in the market. More demand for government bonds increases the price of bonds and lowers bond yields. In turn, the lower bond yields flow through to lower borrowing rates for household and businesses. That's the bottom left-hand corner here. From there, the transmission of those lower borrowing rates is similar to that of a cash rate reduction that I talked about earlier. At the same time, when the Reserve Bank buys a bond, it credits the account of the bank that it buys the bond from. So our balance sheet gets bigger. On the asset side, there is a government bond, and on the liability side, there's a deposit of the bank in the form of a higher exchange settlement balance. So the money supply is increased, though in electronic form rather than physical form. When the bond matures, the government repays us just as it does any other bondholder, and our balance sheet shrinks. So our bond holdings decline, and that's matched by a decline in ES balances. So I said about us buying these bonds for banks, but the banks are generally intermediaries in this transaction. The bonds that the banks sell to the RBA in turn have probably been bought from an investor in government bonds such as a super fund. That investor now has more money in the bank in their bank account, which does not pay them much of a return. And that incentivizes investors to switch to other assets to earn a higher rate of return. This increases the price of these other assets, such as equity prices, and lowers interest rates on other fixed income assets. So that's the right-hand side of this schematic that I'm talking about. Now, that bond investor might be a foreign investor. They may choose to invest the money in assets in other countries, which leads to a lower exchange rate here in Australia. So bond purchases work through a number of channels to put downward pressure on interest rates for the government, households and businesses, as well as downward pressure on the exchange rate. But there's also another important channel by which bond purchases operate, and that's the signalling effect, which is the second line of the second box on this graph schematic. So as I said earlier, bond purchase programs have been introduced by central banks when policy interest rates have been reduced to around their lower limit. And the bond purchases reinforce the view that the central bank will be keeping the policy rate low for a long period of time. That is, they reinforce the forward guidance. The presumption is that the central bank will stop its bond purchases, stop new bond purchases before it begins to raise its policy rate. Now, that doesn't mean that the day we stop buying bonds is the day that the policy rate increases. There may well be quite a period of time between those two actions. Rather, it's a statement about the sequencing of policy actions. So since the financial crisis, there's been a program of research into the effects of bond purchases. And recently, I was involved as an external advisor in a review by the Bank of England of its own QE program. And that review summarised the state of research into the effects of quantitative easing. And the review highlighted that much of the research is focused on the impact of QE on financial conditions, particularly bond yields and interest rates. But it noted there was much less research of the impact of QE on output inflation. So how should we think about what is the appropriate size of the bond purchase program? How stimulatory is the bond purchase program we have here in Australia? So the general assessment of the research literature is that it's the stock of central bank purchases that matters rather than the flow. So it's the $100 billion we've bought, or the $200 billion we will have bought, rather than the fact we're buying at $5 billion a week. So although clearly those two things are closely related. But one important implication of the fact that it's the stock that matters is that the stimulus remains in place even when the bond purchase program finishes. The stimulus only begins to unwind as the bonds that the central bank has bought actually mature. So our estimate of the impact of that first $100 billion that was announced back in November was that it would reduce the 10-year bond yield by around 30 basis points. And those lower bond yields would in turn put some downward pressure on the exchange rate. We derived that estimate based on a review of the experience in other economies, including the literature that was reviewed in that Bank of England report. And our assessment today is that this estimate has turned out to be close to the mark. And we reached that assessment in a number of different ways, but they all arrived at a similar conclusion. So what I can show you here is the Australian bond yield and the US government bond yield. If you focus on that period, the S and the D in the middle of the graph, which is sort of from September through December, and one way of looking at it, so you can see the Australian government bond yield peaking in around September and declining to a trough in around November, and more particularly the spread between Australian government bond yields and the US narrowing by around 30 basis points. So either which way we cut that, and using the US government bond yield as sort of controlling for anything else going on, we had to take some comfort from the fact that that looks like it had an effect of around about 30 basis points. And in turn, that led to a lower exchange rate and easier financial conditions than otherwise would have been the case. The impact of these easier financial conditions on output inflation is much harder to calibrate. We don't have any historical Australian experience to draw on, although obviously we're accumulating relevant evidence now. Again, we can draw on the experiences in other economies, while noting that the outcomes in those other cases are significantly influenced by their particular circumstances and the structure of their financial systems. An important point, and also in thinking about this, is that when a central bank announces a bond purchase program, the market's going to form some expectation of the total size of the program. For example, when we announced that $100 billion bond purchase program back in November that would run for 6 months, it's highly likely that the market assumed there would be further bond purchases beyond that. That is, it was unlikely there was only going to be one program. And that obviously has turned out to be the case because we announced a further $100 billion of purchases back in February. So that announcement effect of the program on bond yields and exchange rate will include some impact from the market's assessment of the whole size of the bond purchase program, not just the size of the first one. Moreover, as the economy evolves, the market's going to adjust its assessment of what it thinks is the likely size of that program, and that's also going to affect bond yields and broader financial conditions. It's quite similar to the way that the market, before March at least, adjusts its expectations for the future path of the cash rate as the state of the economy changes. But it does make estimating the impact of bond purchase programs quite challenging. We don't have good measures of the expectations about what people actually think about the size of the whole program of bond purchases, particularly at the time of the initial announcement. There are surveys of market economists' expectations about what they think we might do, but they're not necessarily the same as the expectations of people actually who trade in the financial markets who determine the bond yields and the exchange rates. As I mentioned, the aim of the bond purchase program is to put downward pressure on bond yields and the exchange rate to provide stimulus for the Australian economy. We're not targeting any particular level of bond yields other than the three-year target, nor are we targeting the exchange rate. We're not targeting a spread between Australian government bond yields and the US government bond yields. But we do think, based on all the evidence, that the impact of those bond purchase programs has been to keep longer-term yields in Australia about 30 basis points lower than they otherwise would be, and the exchange rate lower than otherwise. But as this graph shows, yields will move as the Australian and global economies evolve. And earlier this year, back in February, there was a rise in bond yields both globally and in Australia. And that rise reflected the better outcomes in Australia and the global economy, and also reflected a rise in the market's expectations for future inflation. So yields rising because economic conditions are improving is a desirable outcome, and it's not one that we and other central banks would seek to resist. The bond purchases are still working to keep yields lower than otherwise, but they're not intended to hold the whole structure of yields down at a particular level. And I might just talk briefly a bit about inflation expectations, given it's particularly popular at the moment. But inflation expectations have risen, as I mentioned, along with that rise in bond yields. But they've only risen to a point that is best barely reaching our target, and certainly not anything more than that. That is, bond markets have moved from expecting a reasonable chance of deflation to expecting only low inflation, and inflation broadly pretty much at the bottom of our inflation targeting range. And that outcome of rising inflation expectations has only been achieved with the large stimulus in place currently. The bond market is not pricing any material risk of an inflation breakout. I mentioned that the general consensus is that it is the size of the bond purchase program that is relevant for assessing the degree of stimulus. So let me just quickly show you a comparison of the size of our program here in Australia, the blue line, with that in other countries. And there's a couple of ways you can show this. You can either show it as a share of GDP, but you can also show it as a share of the stock of government debt outstanding. And here in Australia, obviously, we have a much lower stock of government debt outstanding than there is the case in other countries. And so that makes the line on the right look a bit different to the line on the left. So you can see from this that the RBA's bond purchase program started later, but is currently on a faster upward trajectory to that of other central banks. And by the end of the current program, we will have purchased bonds equal to around about what we've announced to date, to around about 10% of GDP. But because the size of the government bond market is smaller in Australia than elsewhere, we've actually been buying bonds at a faster weekly pace than the OFM has been issuing. And so that line on the right is rising at a faster pace than elsewhere. So in considering the impact of the bond purchase program, we are mindful that that what we're doing doesn't cause dysfunction in the market by the bank holding too large a share. You know, government bond yields are an important benchmark, and so we don't want our bond purchase to push bond yields higher when our intent is to actually push them lower. So let me now turn to talking a bit about the term funding facility, the fourth element, or the final element of the policy package. So the term funding facility provides the banking system the capacity to borrow from the RBA for 3 years at cheaper than market rates. It has two main goals. The first is to lower funding costs for the entire banking system so that the cost of credit to households and businesses is low. And in that regard, it complements the target for the three-year yield and the forward guidance. And the second objective is to provide an incentive for the lenders to extend credit to businesses, particularly small and medium-sized businesses, to help the Australian economy in their recovery. So we provide additional funding to banks who have increased their lending, particularly to small and medium-sized businesses. When we announced this back in March, banks were allowed to borrow up to 3% of their total lending, which is around about $90 billion, until the end of September. And you can see by the end of September back in 2020, banks had borrowed around about that $90 billion, just shy of it. And we decided to increase the size of the TFF and increase its length at our at our earlier board meeting until the end of June 2021. The initial cost of this borrowing was 25 basis points, but from November 2020, when we extended the length of the program, we lowered the borrowing rate to 10 basis points. And that's materially below the cost of banks obtaining three-year funding in the market. So you can see, as I said, the bulk of the initial funding was drawn down in September. And the blue dot here shows the size of the funds available to the banking system as of today, which will be available to them up until the end of June. And we do expect that red line is going to rise quite rapidly from here over the coming weeks to be somewhere around about that blue dot by the end of June. So given that financial markets in Australia are operating well, though, the board announced earlier this week that we're not considering a further extension of the term funding facility. But it's important to remember that the term funding facility will be providing stimulus while the funds borrowed by the banking system are outstanding. It's going to continue to provide to support lower borrowing costs and support the flow of credit, as are all the other policy measures. So let me now turn to talk about what has been the actual impact of all of these measures on the economy. So tomorrow we publish our quarterly statement of monetary policy, which will provide a detailed account of the evolution of the economy. And the main message is that the economy has turned out to be much better than expected. The economy has exceeded all of the upside scenarios that we had described last year. Economic growth has been much higher than expected. You can see here that GDP, we think now, is now back to where it was pre-COVID, which puts Australia in a strong position relative to a lot of other countries around the world, although you can see on the left there that Taiwan and China stand out considerably. But there are a lot of countries over there on the right, with the UK very much evident, which are a long way below where they were pre-COVID. The Australian economy is now back to where it was pre-COVID. Employment is above its pre-pandemic level, and the unemployment rate has declined rapidly to be currently 5.6%, half a percentage point higher than before the pandemic. So the labour market has had remarkable outcomes. You can see here the change in employment where Australia's done particularly well. And at the same time, participation in the labour market has increased to a record high, and that's much better than elsewhere. Household spending has been particularly strong. Household incomes have been very high, which has been remarkable. We've had a rise in household income at the same time as the economy's gone through a historically large recession. And that reflects the large support provided by fiscal policy through JobKeeper and JobSeeker, and more recently by the very strong employment growth. So at the same time as there's been strong income growth, consumption opportunities have obviously been constrained by lockdowns in particular. And that means that household savings are also at a very high level. An important influence on the outlook for the economy will be what household savings do over the period ahead. And tomorrow's statement presents some scenarios that consider that issue. So while outcomes in Australia have considerably exceeded even the optimistic expectations in terms of economic activity, that's not the case on the nominal side of the economy in terms of wages and inflation. You can see here that wages in Australia have declined to historically low levels and most noticeably weaker than in other economies. Inflation has come in very close to where we had expected to be, despite the significantly better state of economic activity and employment. There haven't been any material upsides, surprises to inflation. So while inflation is going to spike higher in the June quarter because of basically the base effect from what was happening with prices this time last year, after those base effects we wash through, we expect inflation to fall back to below 2%. One price that has received a lot of attention because it's been going up has been obviously housing prices. So housing price rises are part of the transmission of expansionary monetary policy to the economy. They help encourage home building, along with the government grants such as Home Builder. And there's obviously plenty of that happening in Perth. The bank recognises that rising house prices heighten concerns in part of the community. Housing price rises can have distributional consequences, and that's certainly an issue that needs to be considered. And there are a number of tools that can be used to address the issue. But I do not think that monetary policy is one of the tools. Monetary policy is focused on supporting the economic recovery and achieving its goals in terms of employment and inflation. It's important to remember that while housing price rises may not rise as fast without the monetary stimulus that we've provided, unemployment would definitely be materially higher if we hadn't provided the monetary stimulus. And unemployment clearly has very large and persistent distributional consequences. So where do we go from here? I've described the package of stimulus measures that the board has implemented over the past year. There are a number of decision points about various elements of the package coming up in the months ahead. So we announced earlier this week that drawings under the TFF will close at the end of June, although the stimulatory impact of that will continue for another 3 years. The current program of bond purchases we've announced runs through to early September, and a decision needs to occur on the yield curve target as to whether to stay with the April 2024 bond or extend it to the November 24 bond. At its meeting early this week, the board announced that we will announce the outcome of both these decisions at our July meeting. Those decisions will take account of the state of the economy and the state of financial conditions, including whether financial conditions are appropriate for the state of the economy. and will also take into account the state of the world economy and the policy settings of other central banks, as is always the case. But the board is prepared to undertake further bond purchases to assist with progress towards our goals of full employment and inflation. And we place a high priority on a return to full employment. And beyond that, at some point in the future, the board will consider an increase in the cash rate target and the interest rate on ES balances. And the board earlier this week, though, continued to reiterate its forward guidance. We will not increase or consider increasing the cash rate until actual inflation is sustainably within the target band of 2 to 3%. And for that to occur, we will need to see further significant gains in employment and a lower unemployment rate. We will need a tighter labour market to lead to higher wage rises. And in our current scenario for the Australian economy, we do not expect those conditions to be met until 2024 at the earliest. So let me finish up. In Australia, the monetary policy response to the pandemic is aimed at ensuring borrowing costs in the economy remain low for households, businesses and governments, and provides an environment that is supportive of credit growth. The monetary policy response we've provided has comprised a number of different but complementary actions, and it's worked broadly as expected in supporting the economy. The recovery in the economy has significantly exceeded our earlier expectations, reflecting the sizable fiscal and monetary support as well as the favourable health outcomes. But significant monetary policy support will continue to be required for quite some time to come. So thank you for that, and I hope that provided you with some insight as to our thinking over the past year. And with that, Peter, I'm happy to take questions.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Guy. It's very clear and lucid. So we're getting a few questions coming in, and I'll just flick you one. I think actually this came in a few minutes ago, and I think you did answer it partially, but I'll read it and you can just sort of see if you want to reflect on it further. So this is from Chris Kiev, and he says, what's the risk of inflation expectations rising in response to this higher expected GDP growth that we've seen, and then forcing the cash rate up sooner than expected? So you did talk about that a little bit, but I guess you mentioned wages, but do you think there's any chance that expectations of inflation can drive inflation itself without necessarily seeing the wage growth?
I mean, it's a possibility, but I think it's a great question to ask, and it's something we think about a lot. So is it a possibility? Yes, but I think it's a very, very low possibility at the moment. As I said, we've seen inflation expectations come up since the beginning of the year, but they've only risen in terms of market expectations of future inflation, have only risen to a level which is just barely consistent with our inflation target, you know, just barely above 2% and nothing more than that. And what we haven't seen really is any evidence of any pickup in wages to date. We've seen some of the wage reductions which went through last year reversed, but nothing more than that. And we really, so while we hear about some pressures, wage pressures around the economy in particular pockets, that's really all they are, is small pockets of the economy. So yes, there's always a risk that expectations may shift higher and shift higher than what we currently expect, but we really don't see any evidence of that to date. But it's certainly something that we will continue to be vigilant about.
Okay, thanks. Chris Moore, who's got to rush off to class at 6 o'clock, is asking, employment has come back strong, however, where is underemployment currently sitting, and how does this affect the landscape?
Chris? Yeah, no, another good question, and I actually skipped over the bit in my written speech where I talked about this, but underemployment has actually come down in line with unemployment, and it's also back to where it was basically pre-COVID. So there's actually, and part of that has been reflected in the very high rise in participation, but we've also seen strong full-time employment growth alongside strong part-time employment growth. So underemployment has actually moved down pretty much one for one with the reduction in the unemployment rate. And so also indicating that, you know, the labour market is tightening up, although it still has some way to go.
Okay. Next question is from Ibrahim. And Ibrahim says, thank you. And then he asks, this QE program is fairly new territory for us all. So eventually inflation will increase and yields will rise, driving down bond prices. So his question is, can you please explain the impact of this effective loss to the IBA's holdings? What happens to this large amount of bonds that have been purchased if they suddenly lose value?
Yep, no, good question. Something we're also very mindful of. So one thing to bear in mind is so that you can think of these, so we bought these bonds at a particular yield on the day we bought them, and we funded them at, this is where the ES rate comes in as well. So we have a fixed rate asset, which is going to pay out over the life of the asset. So when bond yields rise, we do have a mark-to-market loss at that particular point in time, but the final value of the bond on maturity is affected by that. So bond yield rises distribute the value of the earnings we get from buying that bond over the life of the bond, but in the end, we still make money, or we still earn money from it, sorry. It's just a question of the profile of those earnings. So we get paid the coupon yields all the time. So it's a question of how that bond, the rise in bond yields affects, offsets the value of those coupon payments. But it's still, it's still a profitable investment for us. There's an opportunity cost element to it, that if we bought bonds at a particularly low yield or a particularly high price, you could have done something better with the funds down the track. But we don't actually, bond yield rises do cause a mark-to-market loss, but not necessarily not a loss on the income flow we've earned from owning those bonds over the life of the bonds. But so that, again, gets a bit into the minutiae of bond market, of accounting for bond purchases, but it is something we are going to provide quite a lot more information on in the coming months, because it is a question we get asked a lot and is an important one for people to be aware of.
Okay, slight change of tack then. So from James McKeer, thoughts on cryptocurrencies, and is the RBA considering a digital currency itself?
So are we looking at a digital currency? Yes, we are. We've got a program of work which is looking at that. We are open-minded as to whether there's a need for a digital currency. We feel, it partly comes back to what I was talking about, the way bond purchases work. We increase the money supply digitally, not by actually printing money. And so the Australian, we have a lot of digital money in the Australian economy. Most of our payments are done digitally. The share of cash in payments these days is a hell of a lot less and declining. So, and we have a very efficient payment system in Australia, particularly with the new payments platform, and where people can actually get basically real-time value for their payments through the MPP. And so we have something which delivers a lot of the benefits that a digital currency would deliver, not necessarily all of them. And so we are open and looking at that possibility, and we are open to it. But at the moment, we don't quite see the cost-benefit stacking up, but that is certainly something which we continue to look at, and if that cost benefit does stack up, then it's something we'll certainly look to pursue.
Okay, so returning to inflation expectations and global labour markets and particularly demographics. So some economists argue that demographic forces will bring an end to low labour costs, and will this bring a return to inflation, from Shanit Sigal?
Yeah. So Charles Goodhart has got a very interesting piece or book out on this with Mahmood Prapan on exactly this topic, and it's generating a reasonable discussion. So Charles's thesis is basically the low inflation we've seen over the last couple of years has been a function of demographics. Those demographics are changing, and so it's not been much of a function of central banks, but purely a function of demographics. And we're going to be beholden to the demographic shift in the opposite direction. I think it's something worth thinking about. I'm not completely convinced about that. Because I think other things are probably going to change at the same time, including technology, which is probably going to have at least as an important impact on all of this. But it's certainly an interesting thing to think about how those big secular forces have driven some of the developments that we've seen both historically, and where some of the change in some of those secular forces might deliver in the going forward.
Okay. Matt Clark asks, has there been discussion at the Reserve Bank that the three-year bond yield target could undermine the effect of bond purchases, and more broadly, that the purchases of liquid government bonds could have a small effect on the broader monetary aggregates as financial innovation takes place.
No, I don't think, I mean, I think our assessment is the three-year bond yield has been effective. It is holding down and continues to hold down the structure of the yield curve. So, and borrowing rates, and we still see borrowing rates, as I showed earlier, at historic lows. So, no, I mean, we are mindful of, you know, the possibility of dysfunction, but by and large, we, you know, sorry, our assessment is that it still very much remains effective.
Okay, thank you. So, change tack again a little bit. So, Alexander Knott has asked, what was your biggest learning during this crisis, and how has this crisis shaped the way you respond to future crises?
So I'm about done with future crises at the moment because I've had the GFC and now I've had this. So I'm sort of hoping to avoid a future crisis, but that's probably a vain hope. But no, that's a very good question. And I'm also hoping that we not have to experience another pandemic for another century or so. A couple of things. One learning I think has been the resilience of the Australian economy. So why are we where we are today? And I showed a few graphs which show that compared to a lot of other countries, we're in a lot better place. And I think that is the resilience of the economy as a whole and actually the flexibility of the economy as a whole. Obviously, the large fiscal and monetary support has been important, as obviously has also been the great health outcomes and health policy that we've had here. But through all of that, the Australian economy has been really resilient. And I think that's one learning. I think we did see this actually back in 08, 09 as well. But I think we're seeing it again and possibly even more so this time around. So I think that's one. I think the other thing, you know, is that one thing we have done and I think we'll continue to do place more work on, more emphasis on thinking about scenarios in terms of how the economy might evolve rather than sort of be too wedded to particular forecasts, particularly when you've got such large uncertainties as we've had to deal with over the past year. So in our statements of monetary policy, we've placed a lot more emphasis on describing how different scenarios play out and how that might affect things rather than being too wedded to any particular central forecast the economy. So I think that's another learning, I think, from the past year or so. But to be honest, I'm really hoping that we don't have to worry about another crisis, at least you know, for more than another 10 years.
Fair enough, too. So Georgia Burton, and maybe a couple more questions and then we'll wrap up. So Georgia Burton, do you anticipate negative consequences to the increased RBA and state involvement in the free market?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think actually the involvement, the involvement of the RBA and the government in the Australian economy has actually had, I think, very positive. It's been very positive for the economy. I mean, as I said a few minutes ago, that has got a lot to do with particularly the fiscal side as why we are where we are. I don't think so. And the other point I suppose I'd make is if you think about what the alternative would have been, and the alternative would have been an Australian economy which is doing nowhere near as well as where we are today and an unemployment rate a lot higher than where we are today, and that has material costs. So I'm not saying that the interventions are costless, but I think, again, from a cost-benefit point of view, from my calculus at least, the benefits are significantly outweighing the costs.
Thank you, Guy. So another question here from someone called Scottro, who may be a second-year macroeconomics student studying for an exam. They say, can you please explain how relative exchange rates feature into your decisions on interest rates?
Yeah, good question. So exchange rates today and always have been an important part of the calculus on setting a monetary policy, because the exchange rate, which is affected by the relative setting, amongst other things, by the relative policy stance here and in other countries does have a material effect on an economy like Australia. And we've seen that any number of times through history that movements in the exchange rate have a particularly large, you know, have a sizable impact on the economy. And I suspect in WA, you all see that at least as much as anyone else in the economy. So it is something we take account both for its effect on inflation, but also for its effect on economic activity. So, you know, a higher exchange rate does dampen economic activity, puts downward pressure on inflation, lower exchange rate, the opposite. So, you know, exchange rate movements are something that we today and historically all always have placed a reasonable amount of emphasis on in our monetary policy considerations.
There's another question about crypto markets. It is a bit related, but I'll give it to you. So the low cash rate has boosted real estate and relevant industries.
Yep.
If it will potentially boost the crypto market as well, that's a question. Will it potentially boost the crypto market as well? If the RBA is considering regulation policies on crypto markets, in the end, do you think crypto market is a healthy investment?
Well, I am not in the business of providing financial advice as to whether or not it's a... So prices clearly have gone up. Probably had some, you know... I give a sort of trite analogy, but in my, you know, crypto has got a large... has got a lot of elements of gold historically, including when the price goes up and down, including, you know, its potential, you know, its price potentially is a fair way removed from its sort of fundamental value in terms of its, you know, actual use value. You know, obviously prices have gone up. It's, you know, conceivably does have something to do with the state settings of monetary policy right around the world. In terms of regulation, I mean, that's not so much an issue for us. That's very much an issue for, you know, the government as a whole, I suppose, as to how they want to approach that. But yeah, I mean, prices clearly have gone up on a bunch of crypto assets over the last while, and it's probably got something to do with settings of policy, but there are a hell of a lot of other influences on that too.
Okay, so another question here from Shamit Sagas. Shamit is our director of our Public Policy Institute, and he wants to take you up on the possibility of future crises, so you don't want to talk about it, fair enough. But there's an obvious tension between Australia, China, and US. So I guess the question is, what would be implications for monetary policy in the RBA if these kind of situations escalate?
Well, I'd leave that to Schmidt probably to talk about the likelihood of those events. I mean, you know, I suppose we'll have to deal with that as they come, as we deal with anything else. But I'm not sure in any great position to provide any particularly informed insight on the likelihood of that. But, you know, if something bad happens to the Australian economy, that generally requires a monetary policy response, and something good happens, that does too. But I don't think I can provide any great insight as to the likelihood of that, certainly not compared to other people who are much more expert on that than I.
International relations people, good. Okay. Maybe this might be the last question because we are getting on time, but... So the bank is forecast. So Faraz Syed asks, the bank is forecasting the unemployment rate back towards 4.5% by the end of next year, which is incidentally the bank's previous estimate of NIRU. That's the non-accelerated inflation rate for listeners. But if inflation isn't rising to the bank's target until 2024, how much lower is NIRU and why has it decreased further? So I guess what
Particularly looking forward, I mean, we have estimates of the NIRU based on history, but we're not, you know, we're open-minded about where that might be. And it comes back to the point I was making about forward guidance. So we're not going to consider raising the cash rate until inflation is sustainably within that 2 to 3% target band, which means we're actually going to have actual inflation is sustainably within that range. So, you know, we're going to wait and see when we get there, and it's one of the things we do would want to see along to provide that sustainably higher inflation is sustainably higher wages than we have currently, and so we don't, you know, we are open-minded about how low the unemployment rate can fall before we get to before we see those sort of developments. But I'd put the emphasis on the fact that we will be looking to see those developments, not just forecasting those developments. So our estimate of the Nauru is helpful in guiding that, but to something, we're actually going to be driven much more by the lived experience rather than what our estimates might be. And I think, so that's an important element of that forward guidance is, we're actually going to wait to see what actually happens rather than what we forecast might happen based on a model which may or may not be appropriate for the changed economic circumstances.
Okay, I'm going to leave the last question then to one of our honours students in economics here, Evanston. And I'm going to paraphrase it. I'll just throw you one for the last question, which is, how confident are you in your three-year forecasts?
Well, as I said, one out is actually, as I said, we're much more going to be driven by what actually happens than by our forecast. So that's one response to that question. It's probably a good way to finish. So let's go back to January last year. So were we confident that we were going to get a global pandemic? No. We have seen that things do come along, which tend to throw these forecasts off quite a bit. There are often some very large events that are broadly unforeseeable, which can cause you to end up quite a long way away from where you thought you might be. And we had a period in the first half of the 2000s, at least, where that wasn't too much the case. But I think the experience of the last 10, 12 years is forecasts are useful in framing your thinking, but I think you've got to be a bit careful about placing too much reliance on them because, stuff does actually happen. And I think we've seen that in spades over the past year or so.